I'm going to repeat what I started to say in answer to question 94. As to the rough session at Malta, I've already explained that it was rough, and I've explained what the great argument was at the time, and my comment to them about the fact that they were worrying over Bradley's contacts with General Eisenhower, when we had much more reason to worry over Mr. Churchill's constant overseeing of what Eisenhower was doing, which our president was not doing at all. Didn't have much opportunity to do it in the first place, and he was very guarded that he didn't try to influence an Allied commander purely as president of the United States. I think I was concluding by saying that while these sessions of lively arguments came up, and they were lively, and they were very frank, but we always came to a harmonious conclusion, we Americans must keep in mind that the British made tremendous concessions to that posed for them a very difficult situation regarding public opinion. They gave supreme command to General Eisenhower in Africa when we had very few troops there and they had the dominant armies. They gave supreme command and reiterated it to General Eisenhower when Montgomery's famous 8th Army came up along the northern rim of Africa after its triumphant career from the initial fight near Alexandria to the final fights in the Tunisia. The British public would undoubtedly demand for him supreme command, and yet the Prime Minister was able to manage that Eisenhower continued in supreme command and was able to have this reiterated at the time the two armies came together, what was in North Africa on the western part of British troops of the First Army and American troops that were just slowly collecting there. And I say slowly collecting because this is a very slow business. Now here came the victorious 8th Army. But in the face of that situation, Mr. Churchill went ahead and saw that Eisenhower was confirmed as supreme commander. He was outranked. One was a field marshal, and he was, I don't recall whether he was even a general then. I think he was, though. But he was not a five-star general, I don't believe. That can be easily checked. And I thought it was very, very wonderful that Mr. Churchill was able to put across those arrangements, because it must have been exceedingly trying to justify them to the British public and first to the British War Cabinet. So I think that we have a great deal to remember in relation to matters of that kind, where Montgomery irritated and craved command and tried to get a hold of it, and Mr. Churchill went straight ahead, I thought, in a very fine way. He had to represent Alexander's interests and Montgomery's interest, but he stood by his commitments and was able to put them by with his own public and his own political situation. And he had many striking against him in Parliament at that time. Question 35. I'm asked to discuss something of the entertainments at Yalta. First is to Admiral King's room being the Tsarina's. I think I had the Tsarina's room. And his was had been an open sort of a veranda, which they said was where Rasputin came up his ladder to see the Tsarina. However, we were both right together there, and we didn't personally fight over who had the Tsarina's room. That was a secondary affair at this time. As to entertainments, Mr. Roosevelt entertained at dinner I don't recall in a big way, but he tried to have each of his suite for dinner with him, when I thought it was very unwise because he looked very, very tired. I remember he had some of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, American, for dinner one night, and he was quite late coming from his meeting with the Russians and the British, presumably, and looked very, very tired. And I thought it was most unwise that he have to put himself out for a gesture of that sort at that particular time. As to the general entertainment, I was somewhat amused, as nearly as one could be, with the political fights in which apparently I was king of Yalta, so far as the Republicans' attacks on me were concerned. As a matter of fact, when they had the final dinner at Yalta, and it was organized by the Russians, and the Americans submitted their guest list, U.S. Chiefs of Staff weren't even invited. The senior chairman, Lay, was invited. The British Chiefs of Staff were in attendance, but the American Chiefs of Staff were left out. So that was the dominant position I occupied at that particular time, when to lead the debates in Congress, one would have thought that I was cock of the walk all the way through. And I remember Mr. Burns was very critical of the fact that the British Chiefs of Staff were present, and King and I were not in the line, not present at all. I don't recall other entertainments that went on, but I know when Stalin came to a meeting or a dinner, he was accompanied by his guards, who always stood at port arms with submachine guns. Question 36, I do not think so. 37, I would not know how to answer that. 38, I don't recall what we gave her at Yalta outside of the President's Chinese agreement, with which I had nothing to do. 39, what was the German situation in my mind at the time of the Yalta meeting? Well, it was very serious. They were being pressed continuously by the Russians, and we were bending around and getting our way very largely on our portion of the front in Western Europe. It was a question of pressing them in a well-regulated strategy that was all important at this particular time. As in relation to the meeting with Eisenhower at Marseille, I don't recall that his accentuating the need of Russian help against Germany. He had already communicated with us time after time, asking us to press the Germans, the Russians, to hasten their attack. And what we needed was a clearing of the weather in order to... The Russians might be able to handle the bad road situation which confronted them in Western Russia. 40. I did not get the impression at all that Lay and King were strongly opposed to the Russian help in the Pacific at the time of the Yalta Conference. This is news to me. This was news to me when it came out in recent years. '41, I did not talk to the president about the need of making concessions to Russia in order to get help against Japan. Stalin had been very specific as to what he could do if we gave him the time in which to do it. He discussed with me how long it would take to move the troops that have to move through Siberia to get ready for the attack in cooperation with us against the Russians. He went into the days required and the character of the attack, as I recall, and actually he followed out the schedule that he talked over to the day when the event finally developed and the opening of the war with Japan. Question 42. I wouldn't comment on this because it involved so many political factors. 43. No, I was not aware of Stalin's demands, to the best of my recollection. 44, yes, I guess I was impressed, though I don't recall my exact reactions until we got around to figuring the use of the bomb in connection with our prospective move into Japan. 46, I do not recall the material furnished by the State Department. I presume it was, and I did not feel that we had a dearth of material at that time. I was not called into the political conferences. I might explain that the first meeting at Yalta, according to my recollection, was all the principals were present, meaning the President, the Prime Minister, and Stalin, the British Chiefs of Staff, the Russian equivalent formation and our formation, and I don't remember who else, but it was quite a large circular table full, and there were others sitting on the outskirts. Just who they were, I don't recall now. I recall specifically that when the meeting got underway, Stalin read a paper outlining the Russian situation in a military way. All was written, and he read it through. Then when he put it down, it was time for the Allies to proceed, and Mr. Churchill suggested to Mr. Roosevelt that I be called on to state the American side. Well, I had nothing in writing at all, and had no intimation that this was coming, but I had done it before at Tehran, and the situation at that time. And Mr. Churchill called on me again here, at Yalta, the military setup of the Allies. I went through the description of the setup, which was a rather lengthy one, and that completed my part in the conference, aside from listening to discussions, and which continued on in a very, very general way. '46, in relation to Alger Hiss, I think I met him together with three or four other state officials, and Ed Stettinius made the introductions. I didn't recall his at all, nor did I see these other men afterwards, after that meeting, because they went into the political business, with which Admiral Lay attended, and we, Admiral King and myself, and our air man, who was acting in place of General Arnold, proceeded with our own meetings with the Russians' chiefs of staff. '47, I had no impression that General MacArthur was opposed to the Russian entry into the war. Quite the opposite. '48, I expressed no feelings in the matter at all because I didn't learn of it till later. My own feeling was it was going to present a very difficult situation for the president with Chiang Kai-shek. '50, were you aware of the widespread opposition to Russian participation? I don't recall it. '51, I don't recall the paper that Whitney refers to. '52, I thought Mr. Roosevelt looked very badly at Yalta. In fact, I was quite shocked by his looks. The more so, General Watson's appearance. I thought he should never have been allowed to come on the trip. I know when Mr. Roosevelt had us for dinner, this an informal dinner, at the end of a day's conference of the Russians, which we did not attend, the chiefs of staff, I thought he was very tired, and I thought the dinner should never have been had. I was not asked to oppose any of Mr. Roosevelt's actions or approve them, other than the military part, which went right along in the way we had planned. I think Yalta has become so much a political factor, a political discussion, that it'd be almost impossible to get at the real reactions of the time, of the day and the time. And I find in all these things, when you go into the history, historical discussions, and they get into Congress and other things, they are so contwisted that it's almost impossible to discuss them. And you find on the part of officers, very frequently, tragically I think too frequently, that their later states of mind don't accord with what they had in mind at the time. And apparently they are sort of backed out by the political recriminations and accusations. But this is to be expected, though I think it was far too common, except that we had a tremendous political war on. We had a Republican Party that was been out of power a long time. They'd built up a great deal of feeling towards Mr. Roosevelt, and there was some Democratic assistance to it, I believe. And they were trying in every way to find a basis for defeating him in case he ran again for re-election. So that you say, all is fair in love and war. There certainly was plenty of the unfair in this war, however much there may be in the matter of love. But in all of these matters, I find the minute it gets into the political ring, it'd be very difficult for the ordinary citizen to ever ferret out what is the truth of the matter. The accusations are so numerous, so altogether remarkable at times, that you can hardly believe what you read. But of course you have a large number who want to get into the public print, and you have others that feel very deeply and are quite prejudiced, and you have the other historians who really try to get at the basic truths in the matter. Unless you diagnose which crowd you're dealing with, it's very hard. It's a little bit like the Civil War is afterwards. You find that General Lee seldom did anything right. The other fellow could always have done something better. But actually, General Lee dominated an army and led it in a magnificent manner. He had his troubles. Everybody in the world has his troubles. He might have done something different, yes. But there was nobody else could take his place and put up the superb demonstration that he did. You might go into Grant's campaigns. in the wilderness, the terrific losses that he suffered. I believe the soldiers called him the butcher at the end of the thing, but he became triumphant and he won. And that was the great factor. The war was over. Grant was triumphant. There you were. But it was a long time before they began to dig up Confederates who felt that they could have done better than General Lee. Well, I've not yet read of anyone who put up a logical argument to that effect. Of course, you're dealing all the time with the Monday quarterback. In many cases, in most cases, he wouldn't have dared to do the things he talks about. But after it's all made clear and it's all is seen, why then he can tell you pretty well how it ought to have been done. Dr. Pogue, I hope this record proves readable and understandable. It covers a very wide ground of dissension and criticism. I'm just dictating out of hand as I read the questions here. I think that you ought to follow the system of noting down certain things where you don't think you've gotten a satisfactory reply from me, or you think my reply is a rather bad judgment, and keep all those summed up. And when I get back to Leesburg, then you can come down in person and we can discuss all those various matters.
I think it's a very good point there, General. Mm-hmm.